Part 1. Seish. Chapter 1. Lake Baikal, Siberia, June 2, 2007. The still waters of the world's deepest lake radiate the deep, translucent blue of a polished sapphire. Fed by cold, ancient streams that are free of silt and sediments, Lake Baikal possesses remarkably crystalline clear waters. A tiny crustacean, Baikal epishura, aids the cause by devouring algae and plankton growths that degrade most freshwater lakes. The combination produces such a stunning clarity to the water that on a calm day, a silver coin can be seen from the surface at a 100-foot depth. Surrounded by craggy, snow-capped peaks to the north and dense taiga forests of birch, larch, and pine to the south, the blue pearl of Siberia stretches as a beacon of beauty across an otherwise hostile landscape. Situated in the dead center of Lower Siberia, the 400-mile-long crescent-shaped lake curves south to north just above the border with Mongolia. A massive body of water, Lake Baikal is nearly a mile deep in some spots and holds one-fifth of all the fresh water on the planet, more than all of North America's Great Lakes combined. Just a few small fishing villages dot the lake's shore, leaving the enormous lake a nearly vacant sea of tranquility. Only at its southern end does the lake sprawl toward any significant population centers. Irkutsk, a modestly hip city to a 500,000 Siberian residents, sits 45 miles west, while the ancient city of Ulan-Ude lies a short distance from its eastern shoreline. Teresa Halima glanced up from a laptop computer and briefly admired the purple mountains at the edge of the lake, crowned by cotton ball clouds that grazed their peaks. The Dutch geophysicist delighted in the clear blue skies that so seldom graced her home outside of Amsterdam. Drawing a deep breath of the crisp air, she subconsciously tried to absorb the scenery through all her senses.
"It is an agreeable day on the lake, no?" asked Tatiana Borjin.
She spoke with a deep voice in the emotionless manner endemic to Russians speaking English. Yet the gruff tone and a businesslike personality didn't match her appearance. Although she resembled the local ethnic Buryats, she was, in fact, Mongolian. With long black hair, bronze skin, and almond-shaped eyes, she possessed a natural and robust beauty. But there was a deep intensity behind her dark eyes that seemed to take everything in life with harsh seriousness.
"I had no idea that Siberia was so beautiful," Teresa replied. "The lake is breathtaking. So calm and peaceful."
"She is a calm jewel at the moment, but can turn wicked in an instant. The sarma, sudden winds from the northwest, can burst onto the lake with the force of a hurricane. The local graveyards are filled with fishermen who failed to respect the forces of Baikal."
A slight chill ran up Teresa's spine. The locals seemed to constantly speak of the spirit of the lake. Baikal's pristine waters were a proud cultural resource to the Siberians, and protecting the lake from industrial pollutants had fostered an environmental movement that had grown globally. Even the Russian government was surprised at the widespread outcry when it had first decided to build a wood cellulose processing plant on its southern shores 50 years earlier. Teresa just hoped that a Greenpeace rubber boat armada would not appear to assail their presence on the lake. At least her involvement was relatively harmless, she convinced herself. Her employer, Royal Dutch Shell, had been contracted to survey a section of the lake for reported oil seeps. Nobody said anything about drilling or exploratory wells, and she was confident that would never happen on the lake anyway. The company was just trying to cozy up to the owners of some exploratory Siberian oil fields in hope of landing more significant business. Teresa had never heard of the Avarga Oil Consortium before traveling to Siberia, but knew there were a variety of oil companies clamoring in the Russian marketplace. A few of the government-sponsored companies, like Yukosh and Gazprom, grabbed all the headlines. But, like anywhere in the world, there were always some little wildcatters owning a smaller piece of the pie. From the looks of what she'd seen so far, the Avarga Oil Consortium didn't even have a piece of the crust.
They're obviously not pumping their revenues into R&D, she joked to the two Shell technicians that accompanied her as they climbed aboard the leased survey boat.
Clever how they designed her to resemble a decrepit fishing boat, cracked Jim Wofford, a tall, friendly geophysicist from Arkansas who wore a thick mustache and a ready smile. The high, proud black fishing boat looked like it should have been scuttled years earlier. The exterior paint was peeling everywhere, and the whole vessel reeked of wood rot and dead fish. It had been decades since the bright work had been polished, and only the occasional rainstorm accounted for any washing of the decks. Teresa noted with unease that the bilge pump ran continuously.
We do not possess our own sea vessels, Tatiana said without apology.
As the representative from Avarga Oil, she had been the sole interface with the Shell survey team.
That's all right. For what it lacks in space, it makes up for in discomfort.
Wofford smiled.
True, but I bet there's some caviar hiding aboard someplace, replied Wofford's partner, Dave Roy, a fellow seismic engineer who spoke in a soft Boston accent.
As Roy knew, Lake Baikal was the home to enormous sturgeon that could carry up to 20 pounds of caviar. Teresa helped lend a hand as Roy and Wofford lugged aboard their seismic monitors, cable, and towfish, organizing the equipment on the cramped stern deck of the 28-foot fishing boat.
Caviar? With your beer tastes, Teresa chided.
As a matter of fact, the two make an excellent combination, Roy replied with mock seriousness. The sodium content of caviar produces a hydration craving that is perfectly fulfilled by a malt-based beverage.
In other words, it's a good excuse to drink more beer.
Who needs an excuse to drink beer? Wofford asked indignantly.
I give up. Teresa laughed.
Far be it for me to argue with an alcoholic.
Or two.
Tatiana looked on without amusement, then nodded toward the boat's captain when all the equipment had been stowed aboard. A dour-faced man who wore a jacquard tweed hat, the captain's most notable feature was a wide, bulbous nose tinted red from a steady consumption of vodka. Ducking into the small wheelhouse, he fired up the boat's smoky diesel engine, then released the dock lines. In calm waters, they chugged away from their berth at the small fishing and tourist village of Listvianka, located on the lake's southwest shoreline. Tatiana unrolled a map of the lake and pointed to an area 40 miles north of the town.
We shall survey here, at Peshanaya Bay, she told the geologists. There have been numerous surface oil slicks reported by the fishermen in this area, which would seem to indicate a hydrocarbon seepage.
You're not going to take us sniffing around in deep water, are you, Tatiana? Wofford asked.
I understand the limitations of the equipment available to us. Though we have a number of potential seeps in the center of the lake, I realize the depths are too great for us to survey in those regions. Our research objective is focused on 4 locations in the south of Lake Baikal that are all near the shoreline, presumably in shallow water.
We'll find out easy enough, Roy replied as he plugged a waterproof data cable into a 3-foot-long yellow towfish.
In addition to providing an acoustically derived image of the lake bed, the side-scan sonar sensor would also indicate the relative bottom depth when towed.
Are the sites all located on the western shoreline? Teresa asked.
Only the target area in Peshanaya Bay. We must cross the lake to the other 3 sites, which are on the eastern shore.
The old fishing boat motored past the docks of Listbianca, passing a hydrofoil ferry slicing into port on its return from a transport run to Port Baikal on the opposite shore of the Angara River. The sleek, enclosed passenger ferry looked out of place beside the small fleet of aged wooden fishing boats that filled Listvianka's waters. Escaping the small harbor, the fishing boat turned north, hugging the craggy western shore of the cold lake. Deep, rich forests of taiga marched down to the shoreline in a carpet of green, interspersed with rolling meadows of thick grass. The rich colors of the landscape against the crystal blue lake made it difficult for Teresa to picture the stark bitterness of the region in the dead of winter, when a layer of ice 4 feet thick covered the lake. A shiver at the thought made her glad she was visiting when the days were longest. It was of little matter to Teresa, though. The petroleum engineer's true love was traveling, and she would have gladly visited the lake in January just for the experience. Bright and analytical, she had chosen her career less for the intellectual challenge than for the opportunity to travel to remote places around the globe. Extended stints in Indonesia, Venezuela, and the Baltic were broken up by the occasional 2-week assignment like this one, where she was sent to survey an offbeat prospective oil field. Working in a man's field proved to be no setback, as her vivacious personality and humorous outlook on life easily broke down barriers with men who weren't already attracted to her athletic build, dark hair, and walnut eyes. 40 miles north of Listvianka, a shallow bay called Peshanaya cut into the western shoreline, protecting a narrow sandy beach. As the captain nosed the boat's prow into the bay, Tatiana turned to Teresa and proclaimed, "We will start here." With the engine thrown into neutral and the boat drifting, Roy and Wofford lowered the side-scan sonar towfish over the stern as Teresa mounted a GPS antenna onto the side rail and plugged it into the sonar's computer. Tatiana glanced at a fathometer mounted in the wheelhouse and shouted, "Depth, 30 meters." "Not too deep. That's good," Teresa said as the boat moved forward again, towing the sensor 100 feet behind. A digitally enhanced image of the lake bed scrolled by on a color monitor that captured the processed sound waves emitted from the towfish. "We can acquire meaningful results as long as the depth stays under 50 meters," Wofford said. "Anything deeper and we'll need more cable and a bigger boat." "And more caviar," Roy added with a hungry look. Slowly, the fishing boat swept back and forth across the bay, its hardened captain spinning the ship's wheel lightly in his hands as the 4 visitors on the stern hunched over the sonar monitor. Unusual geological formations were noted and their positions marked as the experienced oil surveyors looked for lake bed features that might indicate a hydrocarbon seep. Further studies, using core sampling or geochemical analysis of water samples, would still need to be undertaken to verify a seep, but the side-scan sonar would allow the surveyors to zero in on future geological points to examine. As they reached the northern edge of the bay, Teresa stood and stretched as the captain swung the boat around and aligned it for the last survey lane. Toward the center of the lake, she noticed a large, dirty gray ship sailing north. It appeared to be some sort of research vessel, with an old-style helicopter wedged on the stern deck. The rotors on the helicopter were sweeping in an arc, as if preparing to take off. Scanning above the bridge, she noted, oddly, that the ship's mast appeared to be flying both a Russian and an American flag. Likely a joint scientific study, she mused. Reading up on Lake Baikal, she was surprised to learn of the West's scientific interest in the picturesque lake and its unique flora and fauna. Geophysicists, microbiologists, and environmental scientists migrated from around the world to study the lake and its pure waters. "Back online," Roy's voice shouted across the deck. 20 minutes later, they reached the southern edge of the bay, completing their multi-lane sweep. Teresa determined that there were three lake bed structures seen with the sonar that would warrant further examination.
"That wraps it up for the opening act of today's program," Wofford said. "Where to next?"
"We will cross the lake to a position here," Tatiana said, tapping the map with a slender finger. 35 kilometers southeast of our current position."
"Might as well leave the sonar in the water. I don't think this boat can go much faster than our survey speed anyway, and we'll get a look at the water depths as we cross over," Teresa said.
"No problem," Wofford said, taking a seat on the deck and stretching his legs up onto the side railing. As he casually watched the sonar monitor, a quizzical expression suddenly appeared on his face.
"That's odd," he muttered.
Roy leaned over and studied the monitor. The shadowy image of the lake bottom had abruptly gone haywire, replaced by a barrage of spiked lines running back and forth across the monitor.
"Toefish bouncing off the bottom?" he asked.
"No," Wofford replied, checking the depth.
"She's riding 40 meters above the lake floor."
The interference continued for several more seconds, then, as abruptly as it started, it suddenly ceased. The contours of the lake bottom again rolled down the screen in clear imagery.
"Maybe one of those giant sturgeon tried to take a bite out of our toefish," Wofford joked, relieved that the equipment was working properly again.
But his words were followed by a low, deep rumble that echoed across the water. Far longer and lower pitched than a clap of thunder, the sound had an odd, muffled quality to it. For nearly half a minute, the strange murmur echoed across the lake. All eyes on the boat scanned north in the direction of the noise, but no visible source was evident.
"Some sort of construction?" Teresa asked, searching for an answer.
"Maybe," Roy replied. "It's a long ways off, though."
Glancing at the sonar monitor, he noticed a brief spate of noise that minimally disrupted the image before a clean contour of the lake bed reappeared.
"Whatever it is," Wofford grimaced, "I just wish it would stop messing with our equipment."